In today's episode, I talk with David Chevalier, who is the co-founder of Surf, which is a tool to get data out of LinkedIn in your CRM. We talk about his way, how he went to Paris to study there, to found a company there, how they started bootstrapped, how important it is in product development to be really close to the user. And yeah, let's get it started. So welcome to a new episode of the Digital Economics Podcast. Today I have David Chevalier in my podcast with Surf. He's the co-founder and CEO, and so happy to have you. We met at the Bits and Pretzels, where both a little alcohol involved.
Exactly.
Liked each other. You have a really nice team. I can say that for sure, like really, really cool team. And then we decided you definitely should come on my podcast. Can you explain what Surf is?
Yeah, sure. First of all, happy to be here. I think, yeah, Bits and Bretzels event was the first time for us, going on events, but also Munich, bringing one from Egypt, one from France to this German beer fest tech event. It was definitely something new for them. And they were asking, is it always like this events in Germany? I was like, yeah, often, especially in Bavaria, some beer is involved. But yeah, a short pitch about Surf. So we are basically a B2B SaaS from Paris. Since 3 years around, we connect your CRM, like Salesforce, HubSpot, and so ever, together with LinkedIn, because when you do prospecting, and it starts often finding about the right contacts, you go to LinkedIn. Then it's a pain in the ass to add these contacts to your CRM because you need to do that manually. We have a Google Chrome extension for this. So now it's one click. You have all the contact details in your CRM. We further enrich the information with email addresses, phone numbers by leveraging different data tools. And we also keep updates of your CRM records with the LinkedIn databases plus a few others. Happy to be here.
Okay, before we dive deeper into the product, which I find really interesting, I first of all would like to go a little through your life, because I think that's always interesting to see like the founder background. So you're originally from Germany, you're from the north of Germany, and you made your Abitur, like the high school degree, and then you went to Paris. How did that did just come?
So first of all, yeah, I have a French name, but I think my grandparents were French at a certain time. Never learned the language. However, I always wanted to because everyone that just read my name thought or started to speak French if they could do. So there was always this pain, like, and feeling I need to learn French at a certain time. So that's why France in the first place. I looked because I had 5 years of finance behind me, classic M&A and leverage finance in Frankfurt. And I looked for an entrepreneurship program. So I had a variety of programs in Europe and US. And I found this program between HEC Paris and Polytechnique. So it was a program between two universities. And the main benefit here for me was you have half of the people who are engineers and the other half were business guys. Because for me, when I learn entrepreneurship, I don't want to learn it theoretically. And if I learn it, I took it more because it was a one-year program, or one and a half. I took it more as taking the time to start something and finding some people who want to do something together. And what do you need for building a tech is you need an engineer and someone ideally who knows marketing and sales, so business. So that's why for me, the basis of this program was great because the sourcing was great. As you always had like a good team structure and every component you need to start, you had. And then the program itself was great because both of the universities were great and it was fun also to go to the US. So yeah, for me, it was a plus than having a degree on top, but it was really taking the time for 1.5 years to find a project and start something you like. And now we're here. Actually, Surf was not the project we started or we worked on. It was something else, but Surf was So now what we do is serve was back then solving our own problem we had. And then we just uploaded it on Product Hunt, and then we said, okay, well, maybe here's a side hustle or more. And why not starting a company out of it? So that was the beginning here. And that's why Paris at the end.
All right, let's pause for a moment and let me introduce you to today's sponsor, DealFront. It can be a struggle to reach decision makers, but imagine this, a tool that helps you target ideal fit leads and close deals all within a single platform. More than 10,000 companies, including Amazon, Telekom, Hertz, Siemens, Bubble, and Deutsche Bahn use DealFront to find new customers and increase their sales. The platform provides comprehensive company information, identifies purchase intent, and automatically directs website visitors as leads to your CRM system. The seamlessly integrated tools help target decision makers in your desired companies, convert website visitors into potential customers, and approach companies at the right time. With DealFront, you get three layers of data: market signals, web visitors, and European company databases, plus it's GDPR compliant. Quickly pinpoint decision makers, grab their direct contact details, and start meaningful conversations with DealFront. Head over to dealfront.com for a free demo today. Okay, back to the episode. So you moved to Paris, you made your master. During your master, was it that time when you started with your guys like building your first startup, or was it after the master's?
Yeah, it was at the end of the master. So yeah, as I said, I've been working on another project, which was e-commerce and returns. Because yeah, we have in e-commerce still a lot of returns, and we wanted to kind of prevent returns by some prevention analytics and all that stuff, which was quite interesting. Yeah, then we had this side hustle, actually Roman, my co-founder, and back then Jeremy, who also was one of the co-founders but left before the launch, came to me and were, hey, we need you for website, because I do websites since I'm 14, 15, and we need you for branding, so marketing. I said, okay, I'm in, because what they started with was, and it's quite a funny joke, we needed to do customer discovery in the university, interview 100 people. It was COVID, so we couldn't meet them in person, and reached out on LinkedIn, because we have been in the US at that point, so we didn't know anyone in the Bay Area, San Francisco. So, and we need to keep track of our outreach in a CRM, like HubSpot, for our program manager. And then you pretty quickly stumble over the
But the goal was like finding people who... I think interview. We have a little delay in the internet connection. So you wanted to do user interviews with people in the Silicon Valley who could be interested in your product.
Exactly. Just finding people for our main projects, because we did customer discovery for these main projects. And then we got a list of people. We reached out to them on LinkedIn. And then we needed to keep track of this outreach. So the contacts we needed to create in HubSpot, plus also the messages we exchanged, we also needed to log to HubSpot, because then at the end of the week, our program manager at school wanted to have a check on our development on the customer discovery side. And as students as we are, you know, in the first of the week, it started slower until we got the 100 interviews. And then at the end of the week, we hit the 100 interviews. But then it was about, damn, how do we get now all of these interactions and contacts into HubSpot? Because we didn't start doing it from day one. I was then, okay, I just take the night and I get all of this and sync it by copy-pasting into the CRM. Then we were even looking for automations like Zapier back then. But it was not really working. So Omar said, I won't do that for 100 times, so I will try to program a shortcut. And this was the first day of, back then our name was LeadJet, now Surf, because we created a shortcut that was able to have, in a click of a second, adding the full contact details from LinkedIn in and into the CRM. And that was a huge benefit. And so then project done, we showed it to our program manager, all good. But then we thought, okay, maybe the shortcut could be useful for salespeople, because who works mostly in the CRM? It's the salespeople. And then we were doing another customer discovery with salespeople who we know asked, hey, do you have a problem of manual data entry, keeping your contact records up to date? Yes, we have. Then we went into a 3 month building phase to create the first prototype, MVP. And then we uploaded it on Product Hunt, which is a platform which you probably know. Which is still used today. Yeah, of course, there's more buzz now. It's harder to get to one of the top products. But we uploaded it there, and we were like, okay, let's see. And we also enabled a Stripe billing process because we wanted to build a customer. So, and then it went super quick because the CRMs were reaching out to us. Hey, actually, a lot of our customers are looking for LinkedIn integration, and we stumbled over to you. Don't you want to have an integration with us and build it on Salesforce, build it then fully on HubSpot, on Pipedrive, and so on? And we did that. And after 1.5 years, we had our first million ARR, just thanks to partnership-led sales coming from the CRMs and other partners and product-led. We didn't still do any marketing or sales.
Stepping like a little back to the moment like when you introduced like the product on Product Hunt, how big do you think, because I for my private life it's really up to date. I had a discussion today like how relevant Product Hunt will be for our product we're building right now. And my personal opinion is that it will be crucial, like just for getting a standing, for getting like the foot in the door, for getting like tech people recognizing, oh, there's a cool new software, talking about it on Twitter. Like I really see the big value of Product Hunt, not only like that you can generate like 10,000 installs if you're a product of a day, also that like just people build trust around your product and get to know it and talk about it and that you get some valuable feedback. Is this your opinion as well? So how did it change your starting point?
Definitely. I mean, the influence on Product Hunt, I mean, it changed also, because back then when you had a Product Hunt launch and you were product of the day, it was way different than nowadays, because you have just so many products launching there every day. So it's way harder to get the first product of the day. So that's why a lot of people say, I don't know if I have a chance there, and we just land in a dead end and in a dead listing. But if you make it product of the day, it's still a super good platform to get visibility for you. And I think what also sometimes what you don't see behind the scenes is that still a lot of people kind of almost faking their Product Hunt listing, which you can do now. You know, I mean, you can create a pod with other people commenting, liking, etc., and then you bring it up to product of the day. So if you just say, okay, I want to become product of the day because afterwards I can use it as a marketing badge on my website, being product of the day, so you can build that trust on your website. People still believe, and I also do believe, Product Hunt is a good badge to have, but of course then a lot of companies out there, if you look for new customers and if you look for partners, still there are some, and also some investors still look into Product Hunt, but a lot of Product Hunt launches nowadays can also be, I would say, arranged thanks to pods, etc., but nevertheless it still gets attention for you, and I think that's what you should consider. That's why launch it on Product Hunt, sure.
Yeah, I feel. And I mean, like, even if I'm aware that there are chances that, like, every few days there are, like, paid, like, products of the days. Yeah. Or, like, several, like, the first three places, like, on some days, like all of them are paid or are in some pods. Still, I mean, it's like if you look into the top 10 list, like so amazing software toolings. Like yesterday, I found a tooling for like Christmas gifts, which AI generated, like gives you some, like just a random developer created this for themselves. awesome.
That's why often really useful tools. And you never can on these platforms, even they have measures like with UTM tracking and stuff, so that you can't really fake it. And then they, if they see that they're basically related to you, they still can give you a bad algorithm development. To say that, edited in my mind. So, of course. But still, these platforms are super, super valuable. And if you make a product of the day, I assure you that you have a lot of attention from partners, investors, early customers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so and you get you got this attention, you got the approval that you have like a prototype which is working, which people want, where people are also like willing to pay for it, and then you changed in this second, like, okay, we pivot on this, we go all in, or was there like a phase of, okay, we try to do both?
Yeah, I remember, I think when we had the first 800 or we're close to 1000 MRR, we said, okay, let's jump in full in, and let's ditch all the other projects we had, because we saw quickly the MRR going up. We built our customers from the launch date. That's super important. Your product is always scrappy, meaning you build your product constantly with your customers. So that's why don't be afraid of like, oh, I think it's not crystal pixel perfect. Don't do that. Just go out with the first crappy version. It will get better together with your customers. And they're happy to pay, because if it makes their life easier and they know it will have a few bugs at the beginning, it's okay. That's why they also want to be in that building phase with you. So take them onto your journey and build them. There's nothing wrong about it. And yeah, I think that's important. Yeah.
Did you like really tried to have conversations with customers? Like if you got a support ticket, like inviting them for video calls or something?
Yeah, always. Like this? My Calendly still up today is open. The Calendly link is everywhere. At the beginning, you are product, sales, marketing all in one. And I had like same as we were in university, having customer discovery and having 100 interviews. For me, it was exactly the same. And I went, when I didn't have minimum 5 to 10 calls, demo calls per day, I was freaking out, because for me, it was not only a demo call for selling, it was way more, it was customer discovery. So I wanted to understand what is our persona we attract, what is the ICP, to whom can we sell, because we were not coming from sales, we don't have a sales background. So all these things and how we could place and sell our product was new to us. So that's why I think I had so many customer discovery calls in the first 3 months.
Really?
So helpful. So helpful. Yeah. And still today.
Yeah, I watched like I think every video 4 times in the Y Combinator library. I think it's a great source of like knowledge, like free knowledge available for everyone in the internet. And it's funny because in the end, like every video is just about like, yeah, please talk to your customer. Don't build something in your room, like not hearing and not looking at problems of your customers or ideas of your customers. And I really, really feel that.
Different resources. It's first the customers, the new customers we want to sell to. It's our own, of course, the product department. Then we take competition into account, the market. Where's the market going? What's new in terms of trends, which maybe can use and be early adopter. And then we have the challenge by us founders, because now we have 35 people, we have head of product. And then we always challenge this vision together with us, our partners, investors. And then we come hopefully to something that is working and used by our clients. But I watched also one podcast from the deal founder. Super interesting. I don't know where it was, but I think he doesn't have a lot of podcasts. So here he was really talking, saying, you know, this big headline clickbait, your product is always shit, But he's true in a sense, because it always needs to change, adapt, gets better, and it's always shit. Also regarding the customers, then they often say, I churn, but at the end, they have so many benefits from it, they know it as well, but it's important to have picky clients who are picky on different features and bugs, because otherwise you don't improve.
Yeah, and I mean, if you don't have bugs, you don't change something, you don't have features, you don't experiment, you don't like build something new. Like if you're building something new, there will be always some edge cases.
Yeah, but there are also companies around who get bought, and then they just buy the product. They don't do any changes to the product, just it's laying around for 2 years, don't address the bugs. It's still selling because marketing works, but maybe retention won't be that high then anymore. But it's also the case. Yeah. I see it.
No. Are we talking about Microsoft, Adobe, and Atlassian?
That's not what you said, you see it everywhere, and it's completely normal, because from a also founder-led perspective, there can be, and then it's about fundraising, there can be times where a lot of your budget then goes into product, and not into product, goes into marketing, mostly in sales, and not in product development. Because you may be more numbers driven at a certain point than you are innovation or product driven. And then you see that it works for a short amount of time. Sometimes if they say, I don't care until IPO or exit, I just want to drive up my numbers. And then, how do you say, nach mir die Wohlfahrt in Germany? And you see that as well. So product investments and innovation on a constant basis is very important.
One thing I wonder about, like, you started bootstrapped. How did this work out in the beginning? Like how did you financiate, like, this long time? I mean, of course, like, at some point you had paying customers who were willing to pay for the product, and you could pay yourself with this money. But was there a time before that?
Yeah. So different things. First, again, France is great for founder loan. So you basically get 30K from the state, which you, if you can't repay, don't need to repay. So that was important for us. We get like founder loans of each 50K. Which we are now then repaying back. So this is super important to have access to this. And it was quite uncomplex, just a sheet basically you need to fill out, plus a pitch. And so this, this is great. Then also I asked my parents to jump in and if they want to invest, but I gave them 2% of my shares. And it's great actually, because first your parents say, what the fuck, why did you leave your banking job, which was well paid and all that, to start up? You don't make any money in the first 1 year, 1.5 years, you are going towards your end of 20s, so they have a lot of concerns. Of course they are parents. And that's why I said, you know what, if you invest into the company, into me, I will give you 2% back. And since I did this, they have so much invested. They ask for the numbers. They say, okay, how is it going? and that's great, because then it you have so much more also support, and it changes the whole situation. And if I can give something back at a certain point, I'm super happy. So I think every founder, because I think we are a lot dependent on a lot of different things, whether it's family, it's friends. It's also, you take so much, so take care, think about that you give something.
Yeah, and I think it was a good investment. Like you started sort of 3.5 years ago, and like, I guess they supported you for 1 year or something. And like, if I make the numbers correct now, I don't know, like 2% of like your last founding round, or your founding round was 4 million euros raised, and then 2% are 80K.
Yeah, my mom
gave you less.
Exactly, my mom always calculates her shares. Okay, what? How much? Where's the business? Where's the revenue, etc. So she's really like, I couldn't imagine. Like, okay, mom, you're really numbers driven now. What changed? No, but at the end, that's all on paper, and we will see how the story turns out. But we raised 1.5 years ago. 4 million in equity, which was 3 million in equity, and then something from the state in France to top it up. Since the fundraise, we I think for 1.5 years ago, we now increased our numbers times four. So we were somewhere at close to half a million in ARR, and now we are 2 million plus. So now we are happy this year, end of the year, close to 2x. Could have been better, but we had also a lot of challenges in terms of organization. We grew from 10 people to 30 people, first-time founders. So there's definitely some challenges we will go through. Yeah.
But are you profitable? I guess you aren't, right?
We are a startup. we are very close to profitability, so we don't have that high of a burn. We still have also more than 1.5 years of runway. It was actually a kind of a thinking process in the last months. Shall we go back to profitability, or shall we go for next fundraise? We decided to go for next fundraise probably because we have like 35% of customers in the US already, but we're not targeting them. And that means that for the US to target them, you need to have a bit more cash available because it's way more costly. Building up a sales team in the US, for instance, having maybe a small entity in the US. If we would go to the US first, we would anyway target it starting from Europe because I think you can do that nowadays. For this kind of plans, we would take a fundraise it's here for some hires are needed, product innovation. And I mean, we've found a product market fit quite quickly and got to the first million ARR quite quickly without doing any marketing and sales, which we still don't do. We just hired two AEs and marketing is so far only brand and awareness, but not acquisition. So we found a spot here and we have different plans and different channels where we want to allocate our budget. And that's why we are thinking, okay, maybe we shall take a next fundraise to finance US operations at a certain point and to just go and grow into the next phase. As we started bootstrapped, it's a good learning school how you kind of operate with the cash you have, because at the beginning it was not a lot and you need to pay everything. You don't pay yourself for a year. And that was difficult. Now we can pay ourselves happily. But bootstrap learns you. I think it's a good school.
So you would do that again, definitely, like the bootstrap path, like in the beginning.
I would definitely bootstrap again. Now I got a pop-up problem of saving my audio. I don't know why. You still hear me?
I still hear you, and I don't get a warning.
Okay.
We will see in the end.
We will see. We'll figure it out.
Okay. Let's talk 5 more minutes, and in the end we see. Fuck.
Yeah. I would definitely. It depends on what business you want to start. I think a SaaS company, you can definitely start bootstrapped. And having profitability in mind is especially in today's environment, startup environment, but also macro environment, super, super important. The years of just like throwing money into the market are over, and it's good because it was not healthy. Everyone for just, I don't know, let's say Uber for specific kind of products. I don't know. There was an Uber at a certain time for everything you wanted to have, you know. And it was at a certain point not healthy, because so many companies just were raised with money, which then disappeared. So it was a full throw into the market, burn into the market, and it was not healthy, because you saw multiples on fundraisings of 50. People raised with 20,000 MRR, 80 million. It was just crazy. So Bootstrap, if you want to do a SaaS, it gives you, first of all, a lot of learnings. I wouldn't jump over, because the problem is, when you jump over learning and you didn't understand, then it's hard to go back. So let's say, for instance, you get so much cash, and now it's about, hey, I throw all that cash into ads, but you never did the learning of who is your ICP, who is your target persona. So you're burning cash on something which probably has no return, because you're not reaching the right people. So do that learning. Find out who are your ICPs, to which of the personas is sticking my product. Then go. If you learned it, you can then put money into it. But first, learn it, put money into it. Learn it, put money into it. And I think that's what we have seen in the market, that people just jumped over, jump, didn't understand. And then they burned a lot, and they could never go back. So that's why do the bootstrap phase, for have a profitability in mind, generate some cash, then you can also raise on such more favorable terms, because you already can raise on some cash. And I love bootstrap business.
I really think it also like guides you to doing some things which you wouldn't maybe do, because human beings are lazy and they try to find the easy way, and the easy way is like putting ads on Google or Instagram or whatever, and something like writing a really useful blog article, which is definitely more effort, but something which is helping people, like people are searching for something, you're providing a solution for them. I even had founders on this podcast who were like, and sometimes I program like little tools which are helping customers like for free, and like that's just a way of like a better way of like making a blog article, just solving little problems and in that way getting attention. So not annoying people is, I think, a great way to do marketing.
And negotiations. I mean, if you need to negotiate because it's your own money, you negotiate way different than you do negotiations when it's investors' money, I would say. We had someone when we invested into our first marketing video, I think it was €1,500, because it was a product explainer and nice visuals, and was first 4,000 or more. And I negotiated the price so much down because we couldn't pay more. And we already thought, like, I don't know, 3 weeks about, should we really invest that money? Will it lead to something? Because you don't know. We need to find out. And now I'm negotiating everything, also in private life. I negotiate clothing, whatever it is, I negotiate. And I think that's what you, when you learn, when you bootstrap business. And I don't know if every fundraise company do the same, to be honest.
I think I had the same with traveling. I guess if you're traveling and you're living on a high budget, you book in advance all the hotels and hostels and whatever. And if you're like low budget, you know you have to find some ways. You know, okay, I can't afford a flight. How can I come to Southeast Asia? Where's this Trans-Siberian railway? And then you find where are hotels which are not listed in the internet? And if a hotel is not listed in the internet, it's 10% of the price of like an internet hotel. And you find these ways and these niches, also recognize everything is arguable.
Exactly. You find the hacky ways. That's also what you see in France. You see a lot of bootstrap business, and you see a lot of people who hack their ways, also like before they buy a tool, sometimes they build it themselves. It may be not super efficient because it takes you longer, but in the long run it gives you so much more learnings. The same like a travel story, I think you probably learned way much more to self-organize, to find also creative ways and with less money, because you start the creative thinking process. What could I do instead of just going on booking.com and book a 4-star hotel or whatever. And you meet different other people on this journey. So I love this travel and train story, actually, because I think it can be very much related to bootstrap business. And then you did your learning and you know it, and then you can spend money on it the next time, and you go to the next learning, and then you go through it until you understood it, and then you can spend money on it to then scale it. It's important.
I have one last question regarding like your product, which I try to find a good point in this interview where I'm asking this, and probably you already have a good answer. But when you're explaining, okay, we like transfer data from LinkedIn to like a CRM, I always learned like web scraping is something which you do, but you don't talk about it because it's illegal and it's like complicated with data privacy and stuff. How did you solve that part? Or is it illegal and it's like on the customer side to like use the tool or not?
So we're not a scraping tool because we are more sales productivity tool. What we do different is we don't just go on websites and scrape data and then export it into the CRM or whatever database you want to take. We, from the UI and UX perspective, bring your CRM, like HubSpot, for instance, or Salesforce, and embed it inside of LinkedIn. Because we believe your CRM should be there where your prospecting or sales is happening. So it's not happening in the CRM. It's just a record. It's like a piece of paper, whatever, where you have everything written down. But the sales, the discussions, the contact relationship, and that happens on other platforms like LinkedIn. So why not having for productivity gains your CRM directly there, so accessible? And we don't click ourselves like a robot through different pages and scrape massively. We push the CRM inside LinkedIn. So LinkedIn actually likes that you now spend more time on LinkedIn because you don't switch your tab to the CRM. And then they can earn more through ads and so on. And we also go by click basis, so one by one click. So we could, of course, click ourselves through these pages. But no, you give access to the page. We see basically the page, and then we are like a tube that transfers the information, but we never save the information. The information is always saved on the LinkedIn side or it's saved on the CRM side. So that's why we are pretty, with data loss, we are pretty light. And then not overusing LinkedIn's API because that would be again scraping. I think that's important. And we had a few chats with LinkedIn, and since we do it differently from the other angle, bringing it inside of LinkedIn, it's considered differently or seen differently than just being a scraper and exporting it and being a robot.
So from a technical perspective, it's just I install a Chrome extension and it puts a mask like inside of LinkedIn, which like transfers the messages I write with people to like HubSpot.
You see it's so light. And
But
yeah, that you think actually it's LinkedIn. You think it's LinkedIn because it's so light and embedded into the LinkedIn flow and your prospecting flows that you don't realize actually that you're using a tool. You think it's LinkedIn,
But still, from a legal perspective, I mean, I'm aware of, when a tool like this exists, no one would ever do this. But wouldn't it be necessary, like, to ask the person you're writing on LinkedIn with for their consent that the conversation is transferred to HubSpot?
So, what's important is when you reach out to people. So you're talking about GDPR, right? So that's where I see the point is going. It's important because it's mostly German listeners. So we hear that question all the time, especially in German speaking regions. So what is important?
I guess no one else is asking this.
No. Also other countries, France, data protection, like GDPR laws are getting more strict. So I think what's important is about how the outreach. So when you're writing, for instance, an email and you got the data, like the email address, from where did you get the email address? So there are GDPR compliant ways how to get the data and non-GDPR compliant ways. Non-GDPR compliant ways, for instance, when you got the email addresses from a database which got bought. So it's the data got bought and is somewhere stored in a third-party database. Then there is a GDPR compliant mode, which is called, which is done by testing algorithms. What they basically is do, they test first name, last name at company.com until they get a valid response from the email server. And they just do it on a big rate, just quicker and quicker and quicker. So then you have the data. This is GDPR compliant to get this data because it was a testing algorithm. But when you reach out to the prospect, then it can be considered as, let's say, cold emailing, right? Because you never gave his or her consent, that you are allowed to email him. And here comes LinkedIn into play as a gray zone, because LinkedIn is a professional network, so where everyone has the interest of doing business, because it's between B2B mostly and professionals. So when you, this is how we always advise our customers, want to get the email address and get the contact and then kind of text the content, let's say then after via email, go first on LinkedIn, connect with that person, and just slightly connect, because that's basically an acceptance of a potential B2B relationship, gives the legitimate interest that you could text now and follow up via email, speaking about your services. So that's a gray area. And that's why we always advise our clients, it starts on LinkedIn, the contact creation and relationship. You connect with someone, you start texting someone, then we give you the extra data like email addresses, and you can then follow up via email because you have this legitimate interest, especially for GDPR strict compliant countries. So that's the long answer.
But I'm not wondering about the reach out. I think with the reach out, there are also like laws that you like need this interest, there are also regulations on that. But like when I write someone on LinkedIn, my expectation is, okay, the data of this message is stored within LinkedIn. If I write someone an email, I expect, okay, the email will be received by an email provider and will be stored within Gmail or Microsoft Office, why ever someone should use Microsoft Office. Sorry, I'm today in a weird mood. Yeah, that's my expectation. If I'm writing to someone on LinkedIn and he's copying like this message himself, storing it like wherever, printing it out, putting it on a wall or whatever, like when this data is stored somewhere else than LinkedIn, my understanding would be, okay, this needs my consent.
It's the same like an email. Email you're writing in a business B2B relationship, right? As I said, LinkedIn, you're also starting, it's not a Facebook, it's a social media platform, but it's a B2B professional media platform. So it's same in the business context. So it's nothing different than writing B2B emails to someone where your emails are stored in the CRM and HubSpot because you expect it, because you are used to it. And LinkedIn is nothing else than that, because it's also B2B relationship. And it's not a Facebook, so that's why once you connect on LinkedIn, you actually comply to some LinkedIn terms that LinkedIn is here also for relationships in a professional manner. So that's why you, when you expect and have discussions on LinkedIn, you see more and more companies who store this information as well, as it's not only anymore a hiring platform. It's mostly here now in B2B and professional relationships and sales.
Okay, but the big difference is like B2C, like private people are like more regulated and more safe, and B2B like regulations expect B2B like offices and like employees of big companies to be well educated and be aware of, okay, this data could be stored somewhere.
Exactly. It's not a B2C platform. It's mostly B2B, and mm-hmm. you also have no private emails there. You have business emails. Mm-hmm. So the data laws of GDPR mm-hmm. is way different when you look in a B2C perspective or B2B perspective.
Okay.
I think, yeah, that's the of course the biggest difference.
Yeah, I never really read the regulations. I just have.
Yeah, I'm also not a data protection officer.
As we say in German,
But so we have a data protection officer in the company. So, but yeah, we are completely GDPR compliant as a tool. And I think advising your clients, especially in these GDPR strict countries, on how to use the different tools mm-hmm. in a full GDPR compliant way is important. Mm-hmm. We even give mm-hmm. the possibility in our tool, because we have a few German companies who are very strict about it, that you have mm-hmm. a toggle in your customization that you all the stuff you do mm-hmm. is always GDPR compliant. Because sometimes, as I said, you mm-hmm. could also mm-hmm. connect a third-party tool via API to serve, which mm-hmm. gets mm-hmm. data in a non-GDPR compliant way, because they buy from you as databases. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. but if you have this toggle unlocked, mm-hmm. We always ensure every data that goes in and out of our tool is GDPR compliant. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Learned something new here as well, because I just thought like, okay, it's the same rules for everyone, but I also know for contracts, like if you're signing a stupid contract as like a private person, you're kind of safe, because if it's like really absurd, like it's not like, the contract doesn't count. But if you sign it like as a business person, then you're like fucked. And you have to follow the rules, whatever you sign.
It's completely different. Same when you buy a car, right? If you buy it privately or if you buy it as a company, mm-hmm. There's so many different laws. Mm-hmm. And that's the same for GDPR.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. It's like really late in the evening, and then there were like also these annoying hard data privacy questions in the end. But I really like your path of doing like it bootstrapped, and I really enjoyed like spending time with your team on Bits and Pretzels. And I hope I see you again one next year.
Yeah, we will. I guess be there next year again. I just gotta follow up. I think it's Q4, so I also want to sell the early bird tickets. And we really enjoyed it. We always look, of course, at the perspective of awareness plus conversion in terms of leads and clients. So yeah, for us it was the first year of events, but it was very good for us this year of events. So probably we'll see next year there again, and to everyone else who will be there. Enjoyed the podcast, so thanks a lot. Even for I think we had a little delay, so don't show up on the recording. But yeah, it was a pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot, Luis, and enjoy the rest of the evening.
We had internet problems today, so I hope it turned out well and the episode is okay. I hope you liked the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Please like and subscribe and share it with friends, and just have a wonderful week.